We are joined here live in the studios by local activist and writer Maria Tomczyk.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Here to give us a wrap-up of this exciting last week's news and developments and what we can anticipate in the coming week.
Yeah. Well, at the top of the list this week is a new progressive PAC forming in Seattle. That's a political action committee. And I want to also give an update on the Rich People for Seattle PAC that I talked about a couple weeks ago. That group of progressive organizations, they were actually reacting to the formation of this new People for Seattle group, which I call the Rich People for Seattle. The new progressive PAC is called Civic Alliance for a Progressive Economy. That's versus the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's group, which is called the Civic Alliance for a Sound Economy. The new group, the Civic Alliance for Progressive for a Progressive Economy, involves three organizations currently. Working Washington, which is the labor organization that pushed for the $15 an hour minimum wage, paid family leave and other labor improvements in Seattle and in Washington state. They lobbied the state of Washington a lot the last couple of years to get things like the paid family leave and paid medical leave in Washington state. One America Votes is another of the organizations involved in the new progressive PAC. It's a local immigration rights and minority rights organization. They also endorse candidates running for office in Washington state, and they make recommendations on ballot measures.
So are they like a PAC for One America?
One America Votes, it's their voting rights. They first started out focusing on voting rights because that is a minority rights issue, but they're also working on immigration rights. It's an arm of One America that's focusing on those issues. They're also
One America used to be a hate-free zone, I believe.
Yeah. And then Civic Action is the third organization involved in this new progressive PAC. They were set up in 2017 by a venture capital mogul, Nick Hanauer. His group Civic Action focuses on four issues: voting rights, income inequality, essentially by rebuilding the middle class, that's their focus, climate change and gun responsibility. And it's worked on particularly gun responsibility issues in the Washington state legislature in the past, is now getting involved in this new progressive PAC. You can find more information. They have a website at www.capecampaigns.com. They're currently taking donations. They're also asking candidates to participate in their rating system by filling out a questionnaire and sending them videos, resumes, and other information for this year's. And hopefully they will be rating candidates in the city council campaigns for the upcoming primaries in August.
Videos about them themselves.
A lot of candidates produce videos. For people to click on their websites.
As opposed to videos they get of dirt on other candidates.
Yeah. Or they may record and post videos or send videos of, here's what I said during a public forum or something like that. Okay. Or here was my press conference that I held on this policy, et cetera.
Gotcha.
CAPE was just launched this week, so we don't really know yet how much money they've collected, but we'll hear more as we get closer to the primaries. We do know what other PACs have raised, and the two other large PACs in the city of Seattle are CASE, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC, which has raised $765,000, so almost $800,000, mostly from large corporations like Amazon and Microsoft. And People for Seattle, which I call Rich People for Seattle, has raised about $180,000. And I just wanted to talk about who the people are donating to Rich People for Seattle. At the top donor level, which is $5,000 each, we have a who's who of wealthy Seattleites, including Bruce McCaw and John McCaw, who are members of the enormously wealthy McCaw Cellular family. Tom Alberg, who is also a former executive director of McCaw Cellular and now sits on the board of Amazon. Mikhail Thompson.
I think he's leaving Amazon, though, on the board.
Oh, yeah. Because I'm sure he's getting more involved in Seattle politics.
Yeah.
That takes
you can only
up
sit on so
quite
many
a
boards.
Bit of time. Yeah. Well, we'll see here. Mikhail Thompson is another cellular millionaire who worked for VoiceStream and Western Wireless. and John Stanton, who founded Western Wireless and now sits on the board of Microsoft. Most people know him as the owner of the Seattle Mariners baseball team. He's also donated $5,000. Paula Reynolds also donated $5,000. She's the former CEO of Safeco. She now sits on the boards of GE, the oil giant BP, the pipeline company TransCanada, and the defense contractor BAE Systems. Al Kleiss also donated $5,000. He's chairman and CEO of the huge real estate company Kleiss Properties, which owns more than 24 commercial properties in Seattle and the surrounding area. Now, some of the Kleiss skyscrapers are the 6th and Lenora building downtown, the securities building at 1904 3rd Avenue, that's across Stewart Street from Macy's, the Westin building at 2001 6th Avenue, that's just across Virginia Street from the Westin Hotel, and 1700 7th Avenue. That building spans 7th Avenue between Stewart Street and Olive Way. That's the one that has the Blue Acre Seafood restaurant in it. Also giving $5,000 each were Richard and Elizabeth Hadreen. The Hadreens are owners of the R.C. Hadreen Company, the luxury property developer that owns several luxury hotels, including the Seattle Hilton, the Grand Hyatt and the Hyatt Regency in Seattle, Olive 8 and the Hyatt at Olive 8, the Crown Plaza Hotel and the Renaissance Seattle Hotel, among other many other properties. And then also Joshua Green gave $5,000 of the Joshua Green Corporation, which owns pieces of a number of different companies in the Seattle area, as well as a lot of commercial real estate. And donors who gave $2,500 each include developers Matt Griffin and John Runstad, the construction magnate, and Brad Tilden, who's CEO of Alaska Airlines. And what looks like his wife also gave $2,500. Now, the Rich People for Seattle's C4 public disclosure form shows that they've taken in-kind contributions from Sandeep Kaushik of Soundview Strategies and Tim Seiss and Ryan Bain of CBE Strategies. Kaushik is a public affairs consultant for political candidates, local political candidates. For example, he worked on former Mayor Ed Murray's successful campaign, and he helped get Dow Constantine elected as King County executive. Seiss is a former deputy mayor of Seattle who's turned his political experience into a political consulting job, too. And his partner, Ryan Bain, is a lobbyist for a lot of local major corporations. Now, Rich People for Seattle also owe about $40,000 to EMC Research for, quote-unquote, opinion research. And it's not the sort of expense you'd expect to see from a progressive organization necessarily. And in fact, I want to point out, too, that opinion polls are often used to sway voters towards specific issues or towards or away from specific candidates that you want them to support or to reject. It just depends on how the opinion poll is written. They're also often used to justify a group's activities. You know, we're going to pour a lot of money into city council campaigns because we did a poll back in, you know, 2018. We paid for a poll back in 2018 that shows a lot of public dissatisfaction with the city council, et cetera. Those are the sorts of things you don't necessarily expect progressive organizations to do, but you oftentimes see something like the Seattle Chamber of Commerce do. So the fact that People for Seattle is claiming that they're a progressive group and not at all connected with the Seattle Chamber of Commerce is highly misleading, because the folks who have donated large amounts of money are the who's who of people who own companies that do give to the Seattle Chamber of Commerce and whose interests are already well represented in Seattle politics.
I saw today an article that came out yesterday in Patch about Tim Burgess. And apparently after the Rich People for Seattle received monies from the folks, as you just mentioned, folks over at the Mariners, that completely unconnected to that, Tim Burgess is apparently being asked to now sit on the public facilities district overseeing the Mariners facility there. So,
I mean, it's a way in which these wealthy folks rub elbows, you know. They work on an issue together, and then it's like, hey, you know, come join my company. Hey, come sit on the board. Yeah. Hey, come do this work for us.
According to the article, former Mayor Charles Royer, asked him to sit on the board.
Yeah, he's also involved in Rich People for Seattle.
As is one of his sons.
Jordan Royer, yeah.
So, and I guess the Dow Constantine had was the one that put the whole pushed the whole thing forward. And Dow Constantine's spokesperson said, "Oh no, Dow had no knowledge of any of that prior to him putting that forward."
So. I mean, these folks all know each other. They all go to the same restaurants. They all sit on the same boards. You know, they all go to the same, you know, charitable fundraisers for the symphony and so forth.
They break wishbones together at Thanksgiving.
Exactly. So it's not surprising to see this.
All right. Well, speaking of cozy relationships, out this week, multiple papers had the press releases from Amazon.
By Amazon and Microsoft, yeah, about their affordable housing donations. The Seattle Times printed a story. Their story was entitled "Amazon, Microsoft, and Others Give Tens of Millions for Homeless Housing," essentially repeating what the Amazon and Microsoft corporate press releases said. And it really made it sound like it was a great thing that the employee hours tax was repealed, because now those big corporations that would have been taxed are actually giving even more money towards building housing for the homeless. That was the point of the article that Seattle Times pointed out. But that's actually opposite of the true numbers. The employee hours tax would have raised about $45 million per year in its pared down version. The original employee hours tax would have been at least double that, and the tax rate would have increased with inflation. And the pared down version that Amazon had fought with the city council over and eventually signed off on for the city council to pass was less than half of the original proposal of the employee hours tax. So what Amazon and Microsoft actually announced in their press release was a $5 million donation from each of them, a one-time donation. Amazon also committed to matching their employees' contributions up to an additional $5 million, and that they would give $3 million for affordable housing in Arlington, Virginia, where their new headquarters will be. Now, you look at that and you go, okay, that's a business move, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's a total of $8 million one-time contribution from Amazon, right, that might go up to $13 million depending on how much their employees can give. Let's look at what their employees make, okay, at Amazon. They got hit with a lot of criticism in 2018 because the median wage for Amazon employees was $28,446 per year, not a livable wage. The lowest salary for a person at Amazon last year was $25,517. So very far away from, you know, those six digit millionaires working in their executive offices. Now, in October of 2018, Amazon said that they were going to raise their minimum wage to $15 per hour for all of their pickers. Those are the people who work in their warehouses and get the lowest wage. But still, that puts a full-time picker, and a lot of them are not full-time, at $31,200 a year. Not exactly a lot of money. So not many of those Amazon employees, I bet, are going to be given much money in donations for affordable housing. So I doubt that contribution from Amazon is going to go up to $13 million. It'll stay at $8 million. Now, let me point out, too, Amazon's gross profit in 2018 was $93.7 billion, a 42% increase over their gross profit in 2017. Okay. Now, you take some, let's remember, too, that the difference between $1 million and $1 billion is 1,000 times. It's three zeros, right? It's not 100 times. It's not 10 times.
Right.
Okay. So $8 million for a company whose gross profit was almost $94 billion is literally like me going to my change jar and pulling out a few quarters and giving them to a homeless person and then trying to make a big deal out of that.
Yeah. Sending out a press release about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a press conference and having all the local papers pick up on it.
And saying, gosh, we're doing more now than we would have if we'd been paying the employee hours tax. Well, no. Let's look at what the employee hours tax would have taxed them, right? The employee hours tax was based on the number of hours an employee worked per year multiplied by 14.3 $0.323 per hour, with a limit of $275 per employee. So a full-time employee, the employee hours tax at 14 and some odd cents would be, about $298 per year. But there was a limit. The limit is $275. And that limit was to encourage high-tech companies and big companies to hire full-time employees rather than a lot of part-timers. So, for example, two part-timers at 20 hours per week, you'd actually be paying more in tax under the employee hours tax for them than you would for one full-time person, the same number of hours, because of that limit of $275 per employee. And let me tell you, high-tech companies hated that aspect of the employee hours tax. And I think that more than anything got them to say, even after Amazon had negotiated it down to cut it to being less than half of what it was originally meant to be, they still said, we got to get rid of this. Because of that penalty, that little bit of extra tax they would have to pay for their part-time workers versus their full-time workers. Now, also, I want to point out Microsoft's side of this too, because Microsoft does pay their employees more. However, it's not a whole lot more. Their salaries at Microsoft, because we're used to here in the Seattle area hearing about Microsoft employees making starting out at $80,000 or $90,000 and making in the six figures pretty quickly. Their average salary for the entire company, their salaries range from $29,339 to $343,000 and some odd dollars. So the people on the lowest level make less than $30,000 a year at Microsoft. Okay, and also under the employee hours tax, these tech companies would have had to pay not just for permanent staff, but their temps too. They would have had to pay the tax for temps
as Microsoft well. Uses a lot of temps.
And Microsoft uses a ton of temps. So that's the reason why they really pushed hard to overturn the employee hours tax versus down in Silicon Valley, where, San Francisco passed the employee hours tax and is still in effect down there. So Microsoft says that they were going to make a one-time contribution of $5 million for affordable housing. Microsoft's gross profit last year was in a similar range for Amazon, not quite as high, $72 billion, with a 15.5% increase over 2017. Now, when your gross profit increases, your number of employees is going to increase to handle the increased sales and the increased work. So, of course, the employee hours tax would have netted a whole lot more money from Amazon and Microsoft than these one-time donations. Excuse me. And in order for the reporter at the Seattle Times to have come up with this idea that these one-time donations are more than what they would have paid under the employee hours tax, you would really seriously have to be math challenged to think that, or just, very willing to turn around what the company says and parrot that.
Yeah, or take advantage of the fact that this is a state where you can get marijuana legally.
Yeah. Now, the article focused on the total amount that the local nonprofit developer Plymouth Housing Group has raised to build 8 new buildings in Seattle. And that total so far is $48.5 million. But Plymouth is hoping to eventually raise $75 million from rich private donors. And yet, even if Plymouth reaches that goal, that won't be the bulk of the money that they'll spend to build those buildings, okay? They expect the 8 buildings to cost a total of $325 million. So the private donations will only be about 23% of the total. The other 77% is taxpayer money. It's going to come from the city of Seattle, from King County, from Washington State, and from the federal government. Nobody's issuing a press release about that part of it, right? Okay, and now those 8 buildings are expected to house about 800 long-term chronically homeless people within the next 4 years. Remember, there are around 12,000 homeless people in King County, with the bulk of them here in the city of Seattle. So at that rate, we're looking at a 30-year timeline to get people off the street if we're just relying on nonprofit developers to build the housing. Clearly, we can't build our way out of this problem. What we need to do is we need to repurpose the housing stock that we have So that's where things like rent control, rehabbing closed and abandoned buildings, allowing accessory dwelling units, and incentives to convert existing buildings and houses into low-income housing really comes into play. And that's why there's this big push now to legalize rent control and to work on increasing the housing stock in other ways besides just trying to get the money to build enough.
But sticking with this current project that they were focusing on this last week, and the fact that you just pointed out that 77% of that was going to come from
taxpayer money. Yeah.
Isn't when corporations like Amazon and whatever make these donations, aren't they tax write-offs?
Oh yes.
So we essentially...
They are tax write-offs. So here's the thing. They're not just tax write-offs. They're expenses. They're added to the bottom line as an expense. But they are elective expenses. So in a year where the company's not doing as well, they can choose not to make charitable contributions, right? In a year where they're doing great, like last year when Amazon had over 40% increase in their gross profit, they can choose to make as much charitable contributions as they want to kind of offset that bottom line and lower their federal taxes and lower their state taxes. So, you know, obviously, if you're a major corporation, you're going to want as many of your expenses as possible to be elective expenses rather than expenses that you're required to pay, like taxes. And when you see a new expense that's a required expense, like a local tax, and it scales up over time, and it increases when your profits and your number of employees increase, you're going to fight that tooth and nail, and you're going to prefer an elective expense where you can choose when and how much to make. So that's the big difference here between either paying the employee hours tax versus just, you know, giving $5 million now.
All right. And also on the Amazon side of it, they're making a big deal about that they're going to make matching contributions for the based on what the employees do. But that's a standard already amongst major corporations.
Amongst a lot of corporations, yeah. It's considered an employee benefit at a lot of corporations,
exactly.
Not necessarily a charitable benefit.
And you're considered a fool as an employee if you don't take advantage of matching situations like that,
yeah,
aren't you?
Or else you don't have the money to make contributions, and there are a lot of people.
But I'm just saying, it's not something that's unusual.
Don't.
They're presenting it as, look, we're really extending ourselves on this.
Yeah.
When it's basically something that it's like, you know, saying, yeah, and we offer our employees nice clean bathrooms as well.
Yeah.
You know,
and there are a lot of small companies that offer this benefit too.
Exactly.
So it isn't just Amazon.
Right. No, that's exactly what I was trying to get at.
Right.
In a very roundabout way. All right. Anything else on that?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Well, you are—you just got a couple districts to go in your analysis.
Three.
Yeah.
District 5, 6, and 7. So every week.
Just one today.
Yeah. So every week I've been looking at one of the city council district races and going through the candidates, ranking them, sort of starting with the candidates who have collected the most contribution, the most campaign contributions, down to those that have collected the least. This week it's District 5, which is North Seattle, from Broadview in the west to Cedar Park and Matthews Beach on Lake Washington. It spans the north of Seattle, and it includes the neighborhoods of Meadowbrook, Maple Leaf, Pinehurst, Haller Lake, Bitter Lake, and the north half of Wedgewood and Northeast Greenwood and the neighborhood around North Seattle Community College. It includes most of Lake City Way, Aurora Avenue, north of Green Lake, and the massive Northgate redevelopment project. This is Deborah Warris's district, and she's running for re-election. But she is not the candidate who has collected the most contributions. John Lombard, community organizer whose roots are environmental work, he has collected the most contributions. He's been working as a consultant on regulations to protect streams and wetlands for the restoration of salmon habitat. He has served as the president of Thornton Creek Alliance on efforts to daylight and restore Thornton Creek in North Seattle, particularly as part of the Northgate redevelopment project. More recently, he served as co-chair of the North District Council and organized the District 5 or D5 community network, working on issues of better transit service, street safety, more sidewalks, and a new Lake City Community Center. Now, he takes different views of homelessness and crime in Seattle from most of the North Seattle NIMBY folks who want to criminalize the homeless. He also thinks affordable housing and shelters are not enough, and that the drug addiction crisis needs more funding and attention from the city, which I would argue is absolutely true. He views drug addiction as a problem that's separate from the homelessness crisis, but one that's just as important because it's responsible for most of the increase in shoplifting in Seattle. So here's someone who understands where the true increase in crime is. It's not burglaries, it's not robberies, it's not even muggings. It's shoplifting, and shoplifting by people with a drug habit primarily. As for public safety, he supports the police reform process, more funding for diversion programs, for et cetera, and planning and support for the New North Precinct and changes in the system that, quote, effectively address the challenges of repeat offenders, end quote. So he's critical of the city's decision to jail fewer low-level offenders, but he hasn't provided any details, really, on what he'd advocate instead. So he's a bit weaker on the public safety front. Now, regarding transportation, he's most concerned about the city's neglect of Aurora Avenue North, and it's still where it still lacks sidewalks and bus stop improvements that the city promised and has been promising for more than a decade. He also wants to push for more pedestrian and safety improvements around Northgate as part of the Northgate redevelopment. He supports affordable housing, but lacks experience with that issue, although he's very aware that many North Seattle neighborhoods are gentrifying and driving out lower-income renters, for example, around Northgate, Lake City, and Bitter Lake. He's raised about $40,600, with 78% of that in democracy vouchers, a pretty high percentage, and a $110 contribution of his own money. Now, the vast majority of his contributions are from folks within District 5, which is good news, and he has a long list of people who gave him all of their democracy vouchers. So he's clearly going around and knocking a lot of doors to get support from people who live in the district. And then there's Deborah Juarez, the incumbent. She's most notorious for having voted for the employee hours tax and then a month later voting against it. She also chairs the Parks Committee, which established a new local improvement district that's taxing downtown property owners and residents to pay for the expensive new waterfront park. She also co-chairs the Committee on Arena Development. She's a member of the Blackfeet Tribe, who has a law degree from Seattle University. She served on the King County Superior Court, then worked under Governors Mike Lowry and Gary Locke in the Governor's Office of Indian Affairs. She then took a job at Morgan Stanley Bank for 4 years, where she managed multi-million-dollar tribal portfolios and lined up financing for large tribal investment projects, including casinos. And this counts a lot for her pro-business stance. She then moved over to the law firm of Williams Kastner to start a new Indian law and gaming group. And she worked there for 15 years, representing not just tribes, but also Fortune 500 companies that do business with tribes. So she plays up her tribal connections quite a lot. She doesn't talk a whole lot about her connections to Fortune 500 companies and her very pro-business stances. And she's worked on a couple of transportation issues for her district, the pedestrian bridge over I-5 at Northgate and adding the 130th Street light rail station to the Sound Transit 3 expansion. Won't be coming in this first leg of the Sound Transit extension north to Northgate and beyond, but it will come in Sound Transit 3 later on. During the budget process, Juarez proved to be a master at obtaining funding for small projects in her district, like money for food banks and hygiene centers and an apprenticeship program at North Seattle Community College. As co-chair of the Civic Arenas Committee, she's played a central role in securing financing for an NFL team in Seattle, redeveloping Key Arena for the NHL team in Seattle.
Not NFL.
Yeah, not NFL. Redeveloping Key Arena for the NHL team and for transforming Northgate Mall into an ice arena practice complex for hockey. In other words, a big economic gamble there. But, you know, that's what she did as a partner at Williams Kastner. She negotiated these deals, these big deals that brought tourism dollars to tribal reservations. So this is what she's good at, and this is what she does. And of course, she's also a huge supporter of bringing back a basketball team to Seattle. And because she's very pro-business, none of her campaign literature contains any details about how she'd tackle homelessness, affordable housing, police reform, traffic congestion, gentrification, funding for more human services, etc. She's very, very district focused. And her only citywide issue is arenas and big public works projects like the Waterfront Park downtown and the Key Arena redevelopment. And that's the kind of thing, like I said, she worked on at Williams-Kastner in her 4 years at Morgan Stanley. That's what she knows. It's what she does. And it's why the name of her committee, she changed it to Civic Development, Public Assets, and Native Communities. Now, it also explains the source of her financial support for her campaign. She's raised $39,470, almost as much as Lombard. And although she qualifies for democracy vouchers, she hasn't reported receiving any yet, which is weird. Although this could be a mistake by her staff. It could be a reporting mistake. Among her top contributors are a number of Amazon employees, including Tom Ahlberg, like I said, who sits on the board of Amazon. She also has a lot of maximum contributions from real estate developers and real estate service providers from Tim Sice. Like I said, you know, a key player in public-private partnerships in Seattle, and his partner, Ryan Bain, the corporate lobbyist. She also has received maximum contributions from former Mayor Charles Royer, former City Council member Tim Burgess, and current City Council members, get this, Sally Bagshaw and Abel Pacheco, who apparently now is representing the more conservative pro-business wing of the City Council. Not a surprise, given that he was an employee. He's the district four rep. He's an employee of the University of Washington, the biggest employer and kind of the elephant in the room in District 4. Now, Juarez also received maximum contributions from several Native American tribes, the Washington State Democrats, and Frank Chop, the longtime pro-business Democrat representing the 43rd District in the Washington State House, and he's the former House Speaker who's finally retiring. It's actually a really good thing that he's finally retiring.
I thought he was just retiring as chair.
Oh, yes, just retiring as chair, not retiring as his district rep, unfortunately. Now, she has a lot of donors who've given her the maximum $250 donation. In fact, 81% of her donors have given more than $200. But get this, only 17% of her contributions have come from District 5. The largest number, 36%, have come from outside the Seattle city limits. And interestingly, other sizable amounts have come from District 3, 16%, and District 7, 9%. District 7 holds downtown in the high-tech corridor of South Lake Union and, of course, the Key Arena, which is where the NHL team will be playing. District 3 borders on downtown in South Lake Union and has the highest income neighborhoods in the city, Madrona, Broadmoor, and Madison Park. Also, a lot of folks who work in downtown in South Lake Union probably live in Districts 3 and District 7, including a lot of those Amazon employees. And Amazon employees account for a full 13% of her contributions. And I would have to say it's very unusual for one employer to account for that much of a city council candidate's contributions, at least among the candidates I've looked at so far. Now, the third big candidate in this race is Ann Davison Sattler. She's running as the mom in tennis shoes. She's actually a lawyer whose focus is business and employment law, contracts, and intellectual property. So don't be fooled by her, "I just like to take my kids to the park," speeches. Her civic activity appears to be limited to school fundraisers and her co-op preschool board. So she has no experience sitting on any other volunteer boards or working for any other organizations other than educational and school-related ones that I could see. Her number one campaign issue is to set up FEMA-style tents for the homeless and make all shelters 24-hour access, although she doesn't have a plan for coming up with the money needed to pay for this. She'd like to then criminalize homelessness and put homeless people to work cleaning streets, parks, and buildings, including, I suppose, the severely physically handicapped disabled people and the mentally ill. And I just want to point out, I cannot foresee how you could get the one homeless guy who lives outside my building who is in a wheelchair because he no longer has both of his legs. I don't know how you could get him to clean streets. Seriously. She also complains that Seattle has more homeless people than the other cities in King County. So I guess we would just, under her plan, sweep a few more homeless people out to the suburbs. As for substance abuse, she does not like the idea of low barrier shelters or safe consumption sites. She wants all drug users to be swept up and taken immediately to detox centers. And yet she wants to expand methadone clinics. And she apparently doesn't see any inherent contradictions between methadone clinics, which usually dispense maintenance doses of methadone to people who live in the community, versus, you know, essentially jailing people who are drug users and making them detox immediately. Now, regarding affordable housing, she thinks that turning Section 8 services over to the county will make them more efficient without giving any reasons or support for that. She has no other plan for building or financing new affordable housing. And like Deborah Juarez, she wants the Seattle Supersonics basketball team back in Seattle. She's very much part of the Save Our Seattle sort of NIMBY neighborhood folks who want to criminalize homeless, you know, don't like increased density in their housing. They want to preserve their on-street parking, et cetera, et cetera. She has raised $29,332, and 49% of that is her own money. Okay. She is not taking democracy vouchers, which is allowing her to collect much higher amounts from a very small pool of contributors. Her largest contributors include Saul Spady, who organized the initiative campaign against the employee hours tax. In addition to the 49% of her own money that's funding her campaign, 20% of her other donations come from District 5 and 12% from outside of Seattle. About half of that is from her relatives in Texas. There are three other candidates in this race who have raised no money. Mark Mendez is an employee of the Seattle Parks and Recreation and has been on the board of the Lake City Neighborhood Alliance. He is also co-chaired the North District Council, but he appears to not be seriously campaigning, and he has no website.
North or Northeast District Council?
North District Council. Okay. Neither is Taylor Mahoney. She appears to not be campaigning. She has no website, but she does have a LinkedIn page. She works as a general electrical administrator at American Electrical Contractors, which is located in North Seattle. And she attended law school at Seattle University for 3 years, but I see no indication of her having gotten a degree. And that's about all the information that I could find on her. And then, of course, there's Alex Zimmerman, who is an habitual troublemaker at city council meetings with his angry and sometimes racist comments. And he's also one of the main targets of the city council's new rules limiting public behavior at city council meetings. So that wraps up the District 5 candidates. Like I say, Lombard's not only ahead in fundraising, but I think he's ahead in terms of understanding the issues versus Deborah Juarez, who is a single issue, you know, let's develop arenas candidate.
That really surprises me that he is ahead in that because, just going up against an incumbent.
It shows what you can do if you really go for those democracy vouchers. There's a lot of folks in North Seattle who probably don't care that much about the other district races in the city and are sitting on their $100 vouchers. So he's been going around knocking on doors, collecting those. And as far as I can tell, Deborah Juarez has not been doing that. So she's been, rubbing elbows, sitting at the expensive fundraising dinners for things like the Seattle Foundation and, you know, getting the checks from the big corporate guys instead.
All right. Well, then that is going to take us on to
national and international.
Yeah.
Nationally, the Democratic National Committee announced the format and the dates for the Democratic presidential debates. There's going to be one debate each month this year, except for August, when everybody's on vacation, apparently. And then one debate per month through June of next year. So a total of 12 debates. And then the Democratic National Convention is going to be held in July, from July 13th to 16th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, next year. The first debate is going to be over 2 days in June 26th and 27th in Miami. So it's coming up here in short order. The hosts are NBC News, MSNBC, and Telemundo. The moderators are going to be three folks from NBC, Savannah Guthrie, Lester Holt, and Chuck Todd. Rachel Maddow from MSNBC will be part of the mix. And then Jose Diaz-Balart from Telemundo will be sitting on one of those two panels asking questions. Day one, we'll have 10 candidates, and day two, we'll have another 10 candidates. And now the DNC said that they did sort of random drawing to figure out the mix of candidates. But I'm going to read the list of candidates for each day, and you can tell me whether you think that's true or whether they fudged the results a little bit. Day one is going to have New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro, former Maryland Representative John Delaney, Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke, Ohio Representative Tim Ryan, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Okay, that's day one. You're asking yourself, hey, where's Bernie Sanders? Hey, where's Joe Biden? Hey, where's Buttigieg? You know, where are these people I've been hearing a lot about?
They must be in the next lineup.
They're in the next lineup. Day two, we'll have the other 10 candidates who qualified. Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, former VP Joe Biden, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, California Senator Kamala Harris, who's also done very well in the polls, Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, California Representative Eric Swalwell, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, self-help guru Marianne Williamson, and test prep entrepreneur Andrew Yang, often called a tech entrepreneur, but he's really made his money through a test prep company. Now, to qualify for these debates, and for the July debates, which are going to be held July 30th and 31st, the candidates had to reach 1% support in at least three qualifying polls and raise money from at least 65,000 donors in 20 states. Three candidates didn't make the cut: Montana Governor Steve Bullock, Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton, and the mayor of Miramar, Florida, Wayne Messam. Those folks didn't make the cut. Now, you can look at that lineup and ask yourself, okay, how do you end up with Elizabeth Warren on one debate separate from all the other major candidates? And I would say the way that you end up with that is you have a Democratic National Committee, and particularly a Democratic National leadership, who isn't afraid to fudge the results when they want to get the results that they want. Now,
there's nothing random about any of their choices.
Yeah, I really think that that's probably what happened here. Now, in addition to, I want to talk a little bit about the format of a debate, which is going to be, 2 hours, maybe 3 hours max if they go overtime. I'm guessing they're going to hold it to 2 hours. That has 10 candidates. Each candidate is going to get maybe 5 to 10 minutes to talk over the course of the whole debate, and it's going to come in little flashes here and there. So it's really going to be the people who can master the one-line zingers, which in my mind makes this sort of a Twitter form of debating. It's not a real debate. It's more sort of a, can I get a quick one-liner in here or there that's going to be memorable? And that isn't very conducive to helping people understand the issues or understand where the candidates fall, where each of the candidates really, what they really think about the issues and what they would really do and the policies that they would push when they're president. It's also not a great way to interview somebody for a job. You don't sit down with a group of 10 people and say, okay, tell me in 30 seconds, or tell me in 10 seconds what you think about this, how you would solve this problem. Again, a lot's gonna rest on how the questions are framed, whether the moderators can ask good to the point questions that can separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago when I was talking about the format of some of these city council district candidate forums, and how with three or four people you can do a good forum. With more than that, you're kind of lost. You have to ask these really pointed questions that are designed to separate the people who understand what the office is about and what they can reasonably do if they're president versus the people who don't really understand. They're just running because they have an issue that they care about, or because they sort of have a formless idea of what the presidency is all about.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. the candidacy is going to be something nice to add to the resume.
Yeah, exactly. Or just running for president makes you know, is going to sell them, help them sell books or something.
Yeah. Like a particular candidate that dropped this week, got rid of all their staff members. Uh-huh. Our own local coffee legend, Mr. Schultz.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
He said, sorry, I don't need any of you for the rest of the summer. Have a fun time.
Well, you know, he's had some health issues. I think he had surgery recently. He had a back condition. He had surgery recently. And, you know, I mean, somebody like him who has that much money can decide to, you know, pay the filing fee and run for president and then just say, oh, well, not doing that. You know, not going there this year. Maybe in 4 years.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. Well, Kellyanne Conway.
Oh, yeah. This week, the Office of the Special Counsel made a recommendation to President Trump to fire Kellyanne Conway. Now, I just want to point out that this Office of the Special Counsel is not the Office of the Special Counsel within the Department of Justice that was headed by Robert Mueller. Okay. It's very separate. It's a nonpartisan, independent agency. This Office of the Special Counsel that investigates violation of civil service rules like retaliation against whistleblowers or violations of the Hatch Act. Now, the Hatch Act was passed in 1939. Its official title is An Act to Prevent Pernicious Political Activities. And it says that employees of the federal government can't campaign on behalf of political candidates. They can make their own political contributions, and of course they can vote, but they can't solicit contributions from others. They can't bundle contributions, and they can't do any campaigning from their workplace while they're engaged in work activities or by using resources from their work. For example, they can't use their official federal government email account or use federal government social media accounts that relate to their job to promote political candidates or political issues. Now, there are a lot of Trump administration officials who violated the Hatch Act, including former Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, former White House Social Media Director Dan Scavino, and Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador. But this week, the Office of Special Counsel singled out one White House staffer as the worst of the worst for violating the Hatch Act, Kellyanne Conway, who is serving as Donald Trump's White House counselor and was his former campaign manager. She routinely uses her White House Twitter account to either support Republican candidates or attack Democratic candidates, especially Democratic candidates for president. She also routinely disparages Democratic candidates when she's being interviewed by the press in her official position as White House counselor, which is an absolute no-no. In fact, during a one-week time period in 2018, she posted more than 15 messages during 1 week on her White House Twitter account in support of various Republican candidates running for election in the midterms last year. Conway shows no remorse about repeatedly breaking the law, and she appears to find it quite funny. Last month, she was quoted as saying, blah, blah, blah. If you're trying to silence me through the Hatch Act, it's not going to work. Let me know when the jail sentence starts. That's her attitude. And, you know, a very common attitude among Donald Trump's White House staff about issues related to the law. I believe it was William Barr who made the remark to Nancy Pelosi at one point a couple of weeks back, you know, When are you going to send the bailiff, you know, because he had refused the subpoenas to surrender information related to the Mueller report to the House. So it's this very common attitude among the Trump White House staff about, you know, obeying the law and actually playing by the rules. Now, the Office of Special Counsel can't prosecute Kellyanne Conway, so she's right about that. They can only recommend that she lose her job. Of course, Donald Trump favors corruption among his cronies, so he won't be firing her anytime soon. And he said, you know, he thinks she's a great person. He's not gonna fire her. But it's worth mentioning that not all Republicans are as corrupt as Donald Trump's crony capitalists are. The head of the Office of the Special Counsel is Andrew Kerner. Trump appointed him to this position. But Kerner was formerly a member of the Republican staff on the House Oversight and Reform Committee, which investigates things. Like, for example, they're currently investigating how the citizenship question was added to the census. And they're also requesting information on the Mueller report in order to investigate whether Donald Trump committed obstruction of justice. The House Oversight and Reform Committee is literally supposed to oversee law violations by House staff and by members of the White House and the federal government. Now, Kerner was also a staff director for Senator John McCain. And John McCain is Donald Trump's nemesis, or was Donald Trump's nemesis in the Republican Party before he passed away last year. And I'm sure Kerner is absolutely nauseated by the Trump administration, by this attitude among the White House staff that it's okay to break the law because nobody's gonna arrest him and take him to court.
All right. That leaves one more
topic today, an international topic, the Trump administration trying to start war with Iran. Now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on Thursday that Iran had attacked two tanker ships in the Strait of Hormuz. And that's just for people who don't know where the Strait of Hormuz is. It's where the Persian Gulf empties into the Gulf of Oman, and that empties into the Arabian Sea. On the north side of the Strait of Hormuz is Iran, and the Iranian coastline pretty much makes up the largest coastline in the Persian Gulf area, has more miles of coastline in the Persian Gulf area than any other nation. On the south side of the Strait of Hormuz is the United Arab Emirates. The other nations that have a coastline along the Persian Gulf include Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, and Iraq, which has a little tiny sliver. Now, the only piece of evidence that Pompeo produced to support his theory was a grainy video that shows a much smaller boat sailing up to an unidentified larger ship and removing something unidentifiable from the side of that ship. The people in the smaller boat are wearing dark robes, not military fatigues. Pompeo says this proves that Iran had planted a limpet mine on one of the two tankers and was trying to remove it before the tanker could be towed away and examined. Now, I just want to point out that this was contradicted by the owner of that tanker that Pompeo said was shown in the video. Yutaka Katata is the president of the company that owns the Kokuka Courageous tanker. And he said on Friday that the captain of that vessel and the other crew members of the vessel told him personally that a flying object struck the tanker, that the two holes in the ship were well above the waterline, so it was not hit by either a torpedo or a mine. That's what he said. So, you know, the very tanker that Pompeo said the video is representing, clearly the owner of the tanker is directly contradicting him. And I want to point out, too, that in all the press reports I've read about this and about the increasing tensions between the United States and Iran over this incident, it is never mentioned that it is very common for smaller boats to scavenge wrecks in the Gulf of Oman. Piracy is a known problem in the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea. And it's the way that many former fishermen now make a living in that area of the world. Most disturbing about all of this is Pompeo's insistence that American interests are being threatened when other nations' tanker ships are attacked in the Persian Gulf. Neither of the two tankers were American ships. The Kokuka Courageous is owned by a Japanese company, and it was shipping methanol to Singapore, so even its contents were not American goods. The other tanker, the Front Altair, is Norwegian-owned, and it was shipping fuel to Taiwan, again, not even an American cargo on that ship. And this is all part of a long history going back to World War II of the U.S. government claiming national interests over the oil resources of other countries and over the shipping traffic through the Strait of Hormuz from the Persian Gulf out to the broader sea. In truth, the main interest here really is in protecting the U.S. economy, which might be negatively effective if oil prices rise when tanker shipments are disrupted in the Persian Gulf. And it really doesn't have to be that way. the U.S. could be moving away from reliance on fossil fuels. But Donald Trump, of course, is trying to postpone that inevitable movement towards renewable energy resources for as long as possible. I also want to point out that out of all of the oil used in the United States today, only 13.7% of that is imported. The rest is produced here in the United States. Most of the imported oil is from Canada and Mexico, and only a little over 2% comes from the Persian Gulf, primarily from Saudi Arabia. So we really do not have a direct strategic interest in the Persian Gulf. Instead, it's all about the interests of wealthy Western oil companies who do have a direct interest in the Persian Gulf. They're partnering with Persian Gulf nations like Iraq, like Kuwait, like Saudi Arabia to extract oil and to ship it on to customers in Asia. Those are the folks whose real interests are at stake. The big multinational corporations, a lot of them from the United States and from Europe, who have a direct financial interest in extracting oil and shipping it to Asia through the Persian Gulf. So when Donald Trump and most particularly the hardliners in his government like Josh Bolton and Mike Pompeo say that U.S. interests are being threatened when Iran attacks ships in the Strait of Hormuz, what they're really saying is American interests equal the interests of big major oil companies.
And in that respect, they...
And in that
correct.
Respect, that's true. That is not a change from U.S. foreign policy since at least World War II.
All right. Events.
Yeah, lots of events this week. Today is the screening of the film Chasing Coral, which is about the loss of coral reefs around the world, and to discuss how to take action locally. That's sponsored by 350 Seattle and Meaningful Movies Project. That's from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at University Heights Community Center here in the University District at 50th and University Way Northeast. Tomorrow, on June 16th, is the Ride for Safe Streets. Meet with other bike riders at Seattle City Hall at 1 p.m. for a rally, followed by a short ride to Westlake Park to promote safer streets for cycling for everyone. That starts at City Hall. The address is 600 4th Avenue. That's 4th Avenue at James Street. There will be a contingent from Northeast Seattle riding down 35th Avenue Northeast to downtown to protest the lack of bike lanes on Northeast 35th Avenue Northeast. And I just want to point out that the city recently repaved and redesigned 35th Avenue Northeast and left out of the plans the original bike lanes that were originally supposed to be part of that plan for cost reasons. So these folks have a big bone to pick, and that's expected to be a large group of folks from Northeast Seattle. Those folks will be gathering at 11 a.m. at Northeast 86th Street and 35th Avenue Northeast to ride down 35th and then join the rally at City Hall. Now, on Tuesday is going to be a busy day. It's campaign launch for the Green New Deal in Seattle, hosted by 350 Seattle and Got Green. There'll be a rally in the lobby of Seattle City Hall at 5th and James at 11:50 a.m. They're asking people to show up wearing green. Also on Tuesday is Stop Deportations and Keep Families Together. That's a protest against the architect of the federal government's deportation machine, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. He's the keynote speaker at the City Club of Seattle on Tuesday. The protest starts at 11 a.m. at the Washington State Convention Center on the corner of 7th and Pike downtown. Also Tuesday you can join Unite Here, Local 8, as they picket the Embassy Suites Hotel in Pioneer Square. Hotel workers have been working without a contract since September of last year, almost a year now. The picketing starts at 2 p.m. at 255 South King Street. And also on Tuesday is a candlelight vigil on the second anniversary of the police shooting of Charlena Lyles. That's hosted by De-Escalate Washington and Not This Time. That's from 8 to 10 p.m. in Pioneer Square at Charlena's photo wall, which is in the alley next to Merchants Cafe and Saloon at 109 Yesler Way in Pioneer Square. Then on Thursday is the Transit Riders Union monthly general membership meeting at 6:30 p.m. at the Seattle Labor Temple at 2800 First Avenue in Belltown in Hall 8. Also on Thursday is Seattle for a Green New Deal mass action meeting. You can help 350 Seattle and Got Green get ready for signature gathering and other activities at the upcoming Fremont Fair and Seattle Pride celebrations. The meeting is at 6:30 p.m. at the Prospect Congregational United Church at 1919 East Prospect Street. That's just east of Volunteer Park on Capitol Hill. And of course, next weekend is the Fremont Fair and Solstice celebration.
All right. Lots to do.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll keep the seat there open for you for next week.
Okay.
And hopefully
thank you.
We might get John back.
And
next
I just
week.
Want to put in a real quick plug, folks. We air content throughout the week, not just on Saturdays. We also air from Monday through Friday. What are our hours, Mike?
9 to 5 currently. Still hoping to expand that here shortly.
What are some of the shows you
well,
air?
Well, funny you should ask that. We start the day with the KPFA Pacifica evening news from the night before. Follow that with the Tom Hartman Show at 10 a.m.
Great show.
11 o'clock is Flashpoints. Noontime is Democracy Now!
Another great show.
Follow that one with Letters in Politics. 2 o'clock, Rising Up with Sonali. 3 o'clock, Sojourner Truth. And 4 o'clock is the broadcast with Brad Freeman. So it's a good lineup all day.
And, so you can listen all day during the week if you're at work. And instead of listening to music, it's a great way to get angry and get motivated.
And to drown out your coworkers.
Yeah.
So check it out.